Good morning, everyone. Excuse my croaky voice. My name's Michael Green. I'm the clerk of Green's List, the host of this morning's breakfast briefing, CPD seminar, the title of which, as you know, is an update on the Sale of Land Act, the presenters of whom are David Lloyd on my left and Bill Rimmer, who will be presenting second. And a brief introduction for David. I think all of you would know David. He's a property law expert. He spent 32 years of his professional life practising in property law. The last 17 of those years, The last 15 of those years as a barrister, the previous 17 as a solicitor. He's been a member of the property committee of the LIV for over 20 years and has, as I say, practised in property law for over 30 years. He brings a great deal of expertise to what he has to tell us this morning about the Sale of Land Act. Please welcome David Lloyd.
Thanks, Michael. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. What I want to talk about this morning is some upcoming amendments to this very important piece of legislation. It never really stands still. There are amendments on a fairly regular basis, and there are two amending acts, or one amending act, I should say, and one bill, which I am going to tell you about. Firstly is the Sale of Land Amendment Act 2014. Now, this has been passed by Parliament, has been given royal assent. The commencement date provided for in the legislation, the sunrise date, is 1 July 2015. However, I gather from reliable sources that the commencement date could be as early as the 1st of October this year. So that's something that everyone needs to be prepared for. Now, what it does, it's the aim is to simplify some of the disclosure requirements in Section 32, reduce duplication, and enhance consumer protection. It's essentially a one-trick pony. What it does primarily is to recast the familiar Section 32 into a bunch, as the Americans would say, of new sections. Essentially what's happened is the Section 32 has been broken down into nice bite-sized pieces and grouped the new sections start at 32 and they go all the way through to 32P, and they're grouped by category. So for instance, one of them, just to pick one, is headed notices in respect of land, and that covers the old the territory that's covered at the moment by 32(2)(e). Now, with accompanying this paper is a comparative table which lists all of the new sections and their origins, if you like. I'm not going to go through section by section, but what for this reason, that in many instances all this amending act is doing is restating the current law, but grouped neatly into discrete sections, each having its own topic, if you like. But there are some changes, and that is the focus of, that's what I want to focus on today. There is there's actually now a definition of Section 32 statement, which, not surprisingly, the definition there is the statement required to be given under Section 32. People will still call them vendor statements, I'm sure. They've been called vendor statements for such a long time. So what changes are there? In no particular order, firstly, duplication, the idea being to save unnecessary waste of paper. Under the current regime, the vendor statement has to be given to the purchaser and it also has to be attached to the contract. Now, under the new regime, there is no requirement that the vendor statement be attached to the contract. That's not to say you can't do it, but you don't have to. So Some practitioners may prefer a standalone vendor statement, which, as I repeat, does not have to be duplicated in the contract as well. Or you could, there's no reason why it can't be bound in with the contract. But you don't have to do both. And there are transitional provisions, which I'll come to in a little while, that allow the use, continued use of a vendor statement that's already in existence and signed at the time of commencement of the Amendment Act. But one of the one noteworthy provision of this Amending Act is that after the commencement date, even if you're using what I'll call an old vendor statement, you still don't have to, from the commencement date, you don't have to have this duplication. So it's not just for the new ones, it's for existing ones as well. There's a few high-tech provisions, 21st century provisions in this Amending Act as well. One of them is that the vendor is allowed to sign a vendor statement electronically. Planning information we're all familiar with, various things require disclosure. The current legislation talks about planning instrument, and that's defined as including a planning scheme. The Amending Act just talks about a planning scheme rather than an instrument. No difference, I would suggest. But whereas at the present time, overlays, for instance, don't need to be disclosed because overlays under a planning scheme are not zoning, under the Amending Act, overlays do need to be disclosed. Specifically, the vendor statement must state the name of the planning overlay. There's no requirement, though, that any further information be provided. There's a new section dealing with the familiar formula, notice, order, declaration, report, recommendation of a public authority or government department, or approved proposal. That approved proposal doesn't need to be from a public authority or government department. Under the Amending Act, disclosure is required where one of these things directly and currently affects the land. Directly and currently are words that are not there at present. However, directly pays heed to how the courts over the years have dealt with section 32.2e. There needs to be a direct effect rather than an indirect one, directly touching and concerning the land, not the property next door or down the street. Currently affecting is a new concept. What that's designed to do is to relieve the vendor of disclosure obligations where you're dealing with a notice order, etc., the effect of which is spent, so that there's no present impact. Now, in some cases, this may be relatively easy to determine. It may be obvious, but there may be instances where it's far from obvious. And if I suggest that if there's any doubt about whether a notice or order, etc., currently affects, it might be wise to put the document in. So far as essential services are concerned, the Amending Act now only requires disclosure of services that are not connected. And that's it, just the following. You have to indicate which of these essential services are not connected. That's as far as it goes. The name of the supply authority doesn't have to be given. So there's a simplification there for vendors. There's also some simplification where there's an owner's corporation. At present, there is a requirement to include an owner's corporation certificate. Under the Amending Act, the vendor has a choice, either include the certificate, and I suspect that's what most people will do, or else supply the information, the required information in the statement. There's also a specific requirement where the owner's corporation is inactive. In that case, the Section 32 statement must specify, or must state that, specifies the word the Act uses, that the owner's corporation is inactive. Now, what inactive means is, by definition, is one that, it's one of these inclusive definitions, so it includes an owner's corporation that has not, in the previous 15 months, had an annual general meeting and has not fixed any fees and has not held any insurance. So those are those three requirements are cumulative. There is a change, what at first blush presents as a change to the purchaser's right of rescission, currently in section 32, subsection 5. The Amending Act makes it clear that the right to terminate exists not only where there is a failure to supply all the information required or where there's been a supply of false information, but also where there's no vendor statement at all. But this is not groundbreaking because early on in the piece, courts were faced with situations where no vendor statement was given at all, and the courts had little difficulty interpreting subsection 5 as covering that situation anyway, even though it only talks at present about false information or failure to supply all the information. A complete absence of a vendor statement, I would say rather obviously, means a failure to supply, is the best example of a failure to supply all the information. But be that as it may, it's now spelled out in the Amending Act. Now, one major change is what follows Section 32P. This is a new Division 2A of Part 2 of the Act, and it's headed Due Diligence Checklist. This is a brand spanking new concept, and it's dealt with in sections 33 to 33C. The first thing to note about the, I'm sorry, I'll take a step back. At present, the vendor statement requires a large number of warning notices. They keep on multiplying to the point where there has to be some serious doubt as to whether a purchaser would bother reading them all. There's way too many. And the government decided that there was a better way to protect purchasers of land. But not just purchasers of any land, this is purchasers of land on which there is already a residence. I'll come back to that word in a moment. And land which is vacant residential land, defined as vacant land on which the building of a residence is permitted. So the due diligence regime replacing the warning notices does not apply to other land, farming land, commercial land, and so on. Residence is not a word, I think I'm right in saying, it's not a word defined in the Act, although the Act does define in section 30, does define dwelling house. But why Parliament switched from dwelling house to residence in some sections, including the sections dealing with due diligence, is a mystery. But I suggest to you that for all intents and purposes, a residence is a dwelling house, at least for the purposes of this legislation, if not other purposes as well. So if we're dealing with, if we're not dealing with the sale of land which already has a dwelling house on it, or vacant land on which the building of a residence is permitted, then the due diligence requirements can be ignored, and there will be no further warning notices in vendor statements either. Now, the due diligence works like this. There will be, and I use the term will deliberately because there isn't at the moment, or at least when I checked yesterday. Step one is for the Director of Consumer Affairs Victoria to publish this so-called due diligence checklist on the Consumer Affairs Victoria website. This is all very 21st century stuff here. That then becomes, well, that is the checklist, and it's not open to vendors to change it. It's an official checklist, if you like, from CAV. What the vendor must then do is ensure that that checklist is made available, is the expression that's used in the Act, to any prospective purchaser from the time at which the land is offered for sale. And an estate agent acting for the vendor has precisely that same obligation. Now, what does made available mean? Well, the Act deals with that specifically, and it is considered to be made available if two requirements are satisfied. The first one is that a copy, a hard copy, I suppose we can call it, needs to be on display or, quote, offered to, close quote, prospective purchasers at any inspection of the property. So I guess on display is fairly obvious. It's there for people to read. It's there with the contract, proposed contract, and the vendor statement. Offered to, I suppose, means you, the agent will be handing it, offering to hand it to you if you want a copy. Agents should therefore have some spare copies if someone wants to take it away and read it. No doubt agents will. But it's not that alone that is sufficient. There is an additional requirement. The checklist must be capable of being accessed, that's another word, that specific word is used, on any internet site maintained by the vendor, which would be unlikely, but normally it would be by the estate agent. And the accessibility involves a link, internal link within the website of the estate agent, or a hot link, I think is the correct description, to another internet site. Presumably that other internet site would be Consumer Affairs Victoria. Significantly, unlike at present, there's no requirement that a purchaser acknowledge having read the checklist. So when I say at present, there are warning notices in vendor statements, and there is an acknowledgement, of course, from a purchaser. But those warning notices will go, and there is no requirement that the purchaser acknowledge that he or she or it has read the checklist. So it's caveat emptor in that regard. Buyer beware. The information is there, that's the idea. Whether purchaser reads it or not is up to them. There are transitional provisions which are set out in Section 6 of the Amending Act. There's a definition of Amending Act, definition of commencement day, and a definition of old Section 32. Old Section 32 is what's the current Section 32. Remember, this Act has not commenced yet. So when it does commence, there is a new Section 32 and various other sections all the way to 32P. Old Section 32 is the section, is Section 32 as in force immediately before the commencement day. That's the definition. And how it works essentially is this, that if on the, let's assume the commencement date is is 1 October. If on that date a vendor statement for the sale of a property has been prepared and signed by the vendor, it must be signed at that time, then it can continue to be used effectively forever, but so long as the land remains, the expression used in the Amending Act is remains for sale. Now, as we all know, vendor statements have a limited currency, and conventional wisdom suggests that after 6 months or so, might be time to get some new certificates or at least update the information if it needs updating. That can still be done. An updated section vendor statement can be prepared and used despite being past the 1st of October, but so long as the land still remains for sale. And the updated version of it does not have to comply with the requirements of the Amending Act, it just only has to comply with the requirements of old Section 32. Now that's not to say that you can't have a new one that complies with the new regime. It may be beneficial to do so, but not on account of duplication, because even though you're using after 1st of October for a property that remains for sale an old form of vendor statement, you don't have to duplicate. In other words, a copy does not have to be attached to the contract. Now, it's only that the trigger for compliance, obviously, if a property is only going on the market after the 1st of October, obviously, the new requirements have to be complied with. But a property that was previously, that had been for sale, if it's withdrawn from sale after the 1st of October and then subsequently offered for sale again, then there has to be compliance with the new Section 32 requirements. So that's the Sale of Land Amendment Act, but wait, there's more, as they say. If you look at the Victorian Government Parliamentary Documents website, there's something that you won't see at the moment. It's called the Consumer Affairs Legislation Further Amendment Bill 2014. It should be there fairly soon. Certain stakeholders, as the government calls them, such as the Law Institute, have been involved in providing input to the government on this legislation. It covers a vast array of acts, not just the Sale of Land Act, but Sale of Land Act is one of the acts that it does deal with. Now, unfortunately, I can't reveal too much about it. I can't go into a great amount of detail because it's apparently cabinet in confidence. I do, in fact, have in front of me a markup of what Section 29A is going to look like. I should have mentioned that. What this legislation will do to the Sale of Land Act is amend Section 29A, which is headed "What is a Terms Contract?" And it defines a terms contract for the purposes of the legislation. Now, I can't go into too much detail because it's apparently confidential, but I'm allowed to say that there is a bill which is to be tabled shortly, and it is likely to make changes to Section 29 capital A of the Sale of Land Act. The Section 29A started life in 2008, and it became immediately apparent that it changed quite significantly the way the legislation treats terms contracts. the old definition had stood the test of time. It was in section 2, as I recall it, and it focused on two or more payments after execution of the contract and before effectively completion of the contract, or the situation of early possession where the contract entitled the purchaser to possession before completion. Both were hallmarks of a true vendor terms contract or instalment contract or whatever you want to call them. The entitlement to early possession or the obligation to make, and I stress the word obligation, to make multiple payments between deposit and completion. The Section 29A replaced the two parts of Section 2 that dealt with terms, dealt with the definition of terms contract. And as I recall it, the Law Institute, for one, was not consulted on this. It just came out of left field. Had there been consultation, it would have been pointed out to the government that there's a degree of circularity in the definition that you propose, because you have at present section 29 capital A1A referring to an obligation on the part of the purchaser to make two or more payments other than a deposit or final payment after the execution of the contract and before the purchaser becomes entitled to take a transfer or conveyance. So I'll refer to that point in time as completion because it's simpler. Then you've got a definition of deposit for the purposes of this section. Remember that there are definitions of deposit in other parts of the Act. But for the purposes of Section 29, capital A, deposit is defined as a payment made before any payment made before the purchaser becomes entitled to possession of the property. So any and all payments. So therefore, any payment before completion is treated by the legislation as forming part of the deposit so long as the purchaser is not yet entitled to possession. So the result of that is a contract, and this is since 2008, could safely allow for multiple payments or instalments over a period of time without being regulated as a terms contract so long as there's no entitlement on the part of the purchaser to possession before completion. That is one of the reasons why this Act was enacted in the first place, to catch multiple payment or instalment terms contracts. And however, they are not regulated at present unless there's the entitlement to possession of, and I stress the word entitlement, on the part of the purchaser before completion, before final settlement. So Section 29, the first part of Section 29A, subsection 1, the definition part, effectively then operates only where the contract obliges the purchaser to make two or more payments after the entitlement, after being entitled to possession, but before completion. Because in that scenario, the entitlement to possession before completion stops payments or instalments being treated as part of the deposit. But curiously, that very entitlement to possession before final completion activates the second limb of the definition in its own right, because a terms contract is one where either there are two or more, there's an obligation for two or more payments, etc., or the purchaser is entitled to possession to possession of the land before the purchaser becomes entitled to conveyance or transfer. So the multiple payment part of the definition, if I can call it that, has rather limited work to do. Nonetheless, it's been held in Otterden versus Portbury Investments a couple of years ago that the definition, section 29A, says what it means and means what it says, despite counsel arguing vigorously to the contrary. that that the court should read in some words that that ought to change the definition effectively back to what it was before 2008. Not a surprising outcome, I might add, and that the reasoning in that case has been followed more recently, I think last year, by a case that Bill is going to mention. I hope he'll mention that one. Port Bean Otford. He might mention it. Yes. Yes, that's the one. Yeah. So, as I indicated earlier on, I can't tell you specifically what Section 29A is going to look like, but the the definition, I think I can safely say that it is likely that the definition of deposit will be changed in order to bring the definition of terms contract closer to back to where it was from 1962 to 2008. At the same time, it's a couple of other issues have been addressed. The new definition 29 capital A will probably also allow for deposits to be paid in multiple instalments without a terms contract being accidentally created. Now, I'm not quite sure what that's about, because what's often overlooked is that what agitates a terms contract is an obligation to make multiple payments. It's not the actual payments themselves. So if a contract provides for 10% deposit on signing, or say 30 days after signing, and a purchaser decides to get the Amex out and pay it off by 10 instalments, that doesn't create a terms contract, because there's no obligation to make them so many payments. There's an obligation only to make one payment. In any event, the definition will make reference, is likely to make reference to payment of deposits in multiple instalments. And also, it will deal with a situation where a contract is subsequently, after execution, is subsequently varied to require a purchaser to make a further payment. And this is an instance where this can be encountered is where a purchaser is in default or is about to default and is seeking some time indulgence from the vendor, and the vendor says, I want a further instalment paid against the purchase price. And that variation of the contract can potentially make it a terms contract with all the consequences that entails. See Otterden versus Portbury, where it was held not to be a terms contract in any event, but had it been a terms contract, there would have been an avoidance right on the part of the purchaser if the purchaser had done it before 4 p.m., served a notice of avoidance before 4 p.m. as they should have. So there'll be something in Section 29A which is designed to remove the risk of the accidental creation of a terms contract where a vendor wishes to accommodate a defaulting purchaser or an about-to-be defaulting purchaser by requiring a further payment against the purchase price prior to completion. That's about it. Yes, sorry, Michael. Yes, Bill's just mentioned one thing to me. There is, this is in 29A, isn't it? Yes, in 29A, I mentioned there are two elements to the, or two triggers for a terms contract in the definition. One is the obligation to make two or more payments, etc., and the other is the early entitlement to possession. At the moment, the Act says or occupation, and it's likely that the word occupation will be removed. There is a distinction between possession and occupation, but I'm not going to go into it right now. But the reference to occupation is likely to be removed.
Thanks very much, David. We may have a quick break for a cup of coffee and a chat and come back for Bill's presentation. Excellent. And we'll have questions at the end of Bill's presentation. Thank you. Thanks very much, David.